interview with Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street. And this is November 29, 2010. It's 11 a.m. The recorder is now on, so I'm going to ask you again. Is it okay if we record this conversation?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. So let me ask you quickly. You know I enjoyed your book, a couple of your books. What kind of responses have gotten to The End of Wall Street from people in a position to make changes?
People in a position to make changes. You mean like congressmen? Or
yeah, congressmen or regulators or former regulators. Pardon?
Haven't heard from... Heard from a few bankers who liked it. Mm-hmm. CEOs and stuff. Have not heard from Tim Geithner or Ben Bernanke or, you know, Barack Obama. Or, you know, haven't heard from heads of committees or anything like that. So.
And from those you've heard from, what have they said to you? And I don't mean to, Roger, I'm not grilling you here. I'm just kind of trying to get. I'm surprised. I think they should have gotten a big response.
Thank you. I mean, they liked the book. It was, they like the focus on capital requirements. I mean, when the book, the hardback came out. The legislation was passed yet, wasn't enacted yet, and although I had some suggestions, it wasn't a how-to or, you know, set the world right.
Right.
So I don't think people read it as prescriptive as much, although there was a prescriptive element to it, but I think they read it more as a narrative about what happened and what went wrong, and you know, although there are 1,000 different combinations of causes and so on, people liked it.
Right. So the timing, when exactly did you finish? When did you make the last changes to your book? Would that have been late 2009 or?
I'm getting my years confused. Yeah, 2009 was exactly when I made the last changes.
Right.
Manuscript was turned in October 09, and it came out in April 10, and then we went on a obviously very fast publishing.
Right. So since you made those last changes, has anything occurred to either reinforce or alter your feelings about factors in the financial crisis?
Two things have happened, I think. There have been three events that were interesting, and the degree to which they altered my feeling was there. One, the legislation, I think, was significant, mm-hmm. obviously, but that doesn't address the causes. I think the suit against Goldman, which came out after the book.
Is that the Abacus suit?
Yeah, the Abacus suit.
Right.
Enhanced my feeling of the degree to which Wall Street was invested in activities which weren't really serving the greater society, and you know, which the invisible hand wasn't working. The idea that if bankers from Goldman or any banker out there trying to make money for themselves, the society will prosper, and you know, when they're out selling stock to raise capital for companies, that paradigm more or less usually works, more or less imperfectly. But and this was in the book. I mean, but when we're just making side bets on derivatives of housing securities, the connection is pretty frayed, and that gave me had I had that information, I would have devoted more time and attention to that. I mean, I think I said in the book that there was more bet on subprime securities and subprime in existence because of these types of instruments. Mm-hmm. And I think the Goldman suit hit at the point of what is the purpose of Wall Street, and was this a section of it anyway fulfilling any useful economically useful purpose? Mm-hmm. The other thing that came out, I think, was the The Lehman 105 violations on the accounting and how they were dressing up, they and apparently others, but certainly they were dressing up their accounting at quarter's end to reduce the their apparent leverage. And I thought that was pretty serious, and I...
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because we were trying to decide how much weight to assign to those violations, and you seem to have... So I am very interested in what you think.
Well, look, we in terms of as a cause, you know, we don't know... You know, the link to the cause is the idea that had Lehman come out and said, no, our leverage isn't X, it's Y, people would have said, oh, in that case, we can't lend you money, or we, you know, the terms will change, and they wouldn't borrow, and there would have been less leverage and less, of, you know, so on. And now, that, as I recall, and I'm doing this from memory, just reading headlines or stories, the amount of leverage they covered up wasn't a whole lot. I don't know if you remember that as well, but I seem to remember that, you know, they were 30-1, and they would have been 32-1. So not orders of magnitude difference,
right,
but just in terms of our, so probably less of a cause than our idea of how far Wall Street got off the tracks.
Right.
And I think, you know, there's a difference between being foolish, foolish in sort of a speculative sense, being incautious, foolish in that sense, and between engaging in chicanery. And, you know, I've never seen anything that Dick Fuld or Lehman did that crossed that line.
That crossed the line between foolishness and chicanery?
Chicanery, or yeah, I mean, doing things they shouldn't do.
Right.
From an ethical standpoint, it's distinct from an economically sensible or, you know, safe standpoint. I mean, they were very much a sort of an LTCM-like company. LTCM didn't do anything wrong. I mean, anything ethically wrong. You know, just way out of those risks. And
right.
Anyway, but this, so this, you know, if you're doctoring your with these essentially sham transactions,
they were treating. If I remember, they were treating the repos as sales rather than as loans to sort of get it off the books, right?
Yeah, and you know, your balance sheet is supposed to give. But there's agreement to unwind them then, and then turn them back into debt, you know, the day later. Your balance sheet is supposed to give an investor and the public an accurate picture, and to the extent that these distorted that picture, you know, then they were doing some things they shouldn't have done from an ethical standpoint. I think that should be in the record. You know, that I mean, you know, maybe the answer is that if you let people become, when their sense of their own risk gets out of hand, they'll do foolish and bad things. You know, like the bank teller who you know, quote, borrows $100.
Right.
Right. But I thought that crossed the line from just, you know, financing too much commercial real estate, you know, doing all those things that got them in trouble.
Yeah, I've heard the expression that the definition of a what's the difference between an ethical violation and a violation of the law is the thickness of a jail cell wall. I was going to ask you about criminal proceedings. Have you expected to see any? I didn't feel you were indicting anybody in your book, but I wondered if you thought that was
I'm surprised that prosecutors haven't looked harder at some of the original issue mortgage firms. I think there was such blatant encouragement in some cases of borrowers to lie in their forms, or such blatant turning a blind eye to, you know, knowing that they would be. The stuff about Mozilla, you know, in his emails and so on, I'm paraphrasing from memory, but talking about the crap they were issuing while he was telling the world that, you know, other people did this, but they didn't, they were fine, and so on. I would have thought, you know, a prosecutor could have had some fun with that. So I'm surprised that That's the area. You know, I didn't expect and don't expect, you know, the Dick Fold or Bear Stearns or so on would be criminally liable. I mean, obviously the arrangement between Fannie and Freddie in the Congress was, you know, morally bankrupt, but you know, we don't send elected officials to jail for, you know, getting us involved in the wrong wars or getting us involved in the wrong housing subsidiaries, and we shouldn't. So we, you know, so that I don't see criminality there.
Right. Do you think that there are any messages that you were trying to convey in your book, or messages that have followed that are not getting through to taxpayers and to voters?
Very much so.
Yeah,
I think that you know, my book, although obviously very critical of Wall Street and the mortgage industry and so on, I didn't see this as a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see the AIG rescue as a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And I basically think of Hank Paulson as a you know, hardworking, patriotic person who, and Bernanke too, who did their best under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And there's been an awful lot of looking at the actions they took in September 08. You know, and parsing them, they should have done this, they should have done that, they should have only bailed out AIG to the tune so the creditors had to take a partial hit and so on. That is, you know, a terrific coffee table discussion. To me, you know, it's like saying Pearl Harbor's under attack. You know, you don't have to take every battleship in. You know, you don't have to shut down the whole island. It's only Okinawa, whatever's under attack. My geography is all screwed up, but
right, I get the point.
All these critics aren't looking at the reality that confronted people then, and the incredible, and they're critiquing their actions with the benefit of the hindsight that Bernanke and Paulson and Geithner and so on didn't have. And these theories about why AIG was bailed out, it's, you know, I said in the book, I'll say it again to you, they didn't want to do bailouts, they hated bailouts. Paulson's a good Republican, unlike myself. Bernanke was a Republican. They did not come to Washington to do bailouts. They said Lehman take the medicine, that was very popular at the time. You know, everybody now says it's a mistake. You know, if you go eat dinner in a restaurant and a bomb goes off, you could say it was a mistake to eat there, but that's not really a useful type of judgment. Everybody then, based on what they knew then, said that you know, we don't bail out investment banks in this country, they should take the hit, and that's what they did. And because the system, within 36 hours, and even then they were saying no money for AIG, is documented in my book, mm-hmm. and because the system was unwinding so fast within 36 hours, they decided that, you know, the hour for theoretical principles such as, you know, moral hazard and so on had passed. At this point, fires had to be put out, and only the government could put them out. And, you know, I think the whole, I mean, I go through the numbers. I mean, you know, Goldman was not going to go down if AIG had failed. That was not what that was about. And, I just, you know, I think there's a JFK in Dallas episode going on, rewriting going on.
Right.
So that's not my answer there.
Do you think that, those are regulators, of course, but in terms of the anger that persists. Do you think all these big bonuses on Wall Street are? Do you think they're creating a false sense of anger, or what's your reaction to them?
Well, no. I mean, I think bonuses are creating a real sense of anger, particularly last year. I mean, even though they're probably bigger this year, although they're not. You know, if you read the headline, if you read the stories carefully, the bonuses of the biggest banks are not bigger. I mean, the headlines always say bigger, but look, I think I've said. I mean, you know, bonuses should just be shareholders should vote on them, and you know, I don't think they should be a non-binding vote. You know, I think the easiest way to do it is just have shareholders vote on any bonus above, you know, I would say $5 million, but something like that. But, you know, under our system, bonuses don't defraud the taxpaying public. They defraud, if they're overly large, the shareholders. And so I think the anger in that sense is misplaced. I mean, in the same sense, the TARP has become a red letter, you know, a four-letter word. Mm-hmm. The TARP was a success. The money was paid back. Those bonuses aren't coming from taxpayers. You know, every bank that has closed the page on TARP has paid it back in a profit. There are plenty of smaller banks who haven't yet. But, you know, the public interest in bonuses. There is a public interest in bonuses because if the timeline is distorted, or is, you know, if people can get a short-term bonus for a deal that won't, the success or failure of which won't become apparent for years later, they'll put on too much risk.
Right.
And
that's the larger question of incentives. And
so the Fed made a lot of noise about making sure that bonuses, that the system of paying them was you know, they were going to ride herd on that, and some of the firms said they were going to do that themselves. And you know, I guess until some agency like yours, or you know, a full-fledged federal agency digs in, we won't know. You know, are they on what basis the bonus is being paid? I mean, that's the public interest, mm-hmm. and it's a strong one. It's a vital one.
Well, I think the link is pretty clear in lots of ways. I think, not least in your book, that it's these incentives out of control did sort of find their did encourage the wrong things. And in fact, when you come back to Mozilla, and where you sort of have a sense that maybe possibly there are some there is some criminal investigation.
Incentives and bonuses that the incentives, and I said this in the book, that did more damage were the incentives to people beneath the, you know, say, top five named officers. Stan O'Neill did not have an incentive to fail, you know, no matter how much money he got. And I don't know how much of that money was in stock he, you know, collected, but he was going to be rich for the rest of his life. He will be rich for the rest of his life. You know, what he lost, you know, was something that beyond his first $5 or $10 million was more precious, was his name, his ability to work. And
right.
He did not want that firm to go down.
Right.
But the person under him, you know, the people under him, who were laying those $50 billion to CDOs, you know, they were paid incredibly well.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to stop them, and I presume they have gone on to get new jobs. And that's where, you know, now O'Neill was an idiot for not finding out what sort of risk they were laying on, you know, until that July 07 board meeting. But we have to assume that that there'll be some idiots in Wall Street, as there are in journalism and elsewhere, and, you know, including every so often among CEOs. So that's why an O'Neill shouldn't be able to pay, you know, the head of his CD, the head guy doing CDOs until the CDOs have borne fruit. You know, until
right.
That's very important.
So no matter what we do, there will be another apotheosis of CDOs, I guess, somewhere down the road.
Of CDOs, well, yeah. It'll be something different. Last time it was .coms, then it was Enron. But, you know, I mean, that's the reason these things keep recurring is that, you know, they always wear a slightly different cloth.
Right. With all the so in other words, with all the posturing and with all the rules and with all the tinkering. Do you think the system is less vulnerable today than before?
I do, because I think that capital regulations are higher. You know, my basic thesis is that banks are going to make mistakes. They always have. They always will. And, you know, just like journalists and regulators,
yeah.
And, you know, butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. if you make a mistake when you're leveraged 30-1, you know, it's, right. it's akin to driving at 80 and
right.
skidding. If you're only doing 60 when you start to skid, the crash won't be as serious. You might avoid a crash, or if you do, it'll be less serious. So I think I do think it is safer now. I mean, that, you know, that what will happen when, you know, when times are good, banks say, they tend to go to regulators and say, you know, we have way more capital we can deal with. This is ridiculous. We'd like to issue more loans. People would like them. You're restraining the growth of the American economy. It becomes very difficult at that point for regulators to say, sorry, that's the rule. So it's, you know, we're still in a recession, or we're still in a recessionary environment, I guess, more correctly. And because we're still dealing with the overhang, we're all more cautious. You know, the question is 5 years from now, when, you know, when something is hot and bankers want to finance that, and they're saying that the, you know, they could do a lot more of that if,
right.
if the capital rules could be loosened again. You know, that's when we'll see if we remain safe. But I think the, you know, both what's happened in Dodd-Frank and in Basel have, for the moment, made the system
Basel safe. Basel III, I guess you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
When I kept, you know, I look at the title of your book periodically, and it means different things to me. I suppose what I'm thinking at the time, but whether the end of Wall Street is a form of punishment, or it's merely descriptive, or
it had a few meanings to me, but it wasn't intended to be punishment. I mean, I think for me it was the. I mean, there were two. The first thing I thought of was that when I started doing the book, it felt like the end of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like that to all of us. I think. I mean, it felt like. You know, that title is a reminder of how you know, it didn't feel like all the other episodes I've lived through. God mm-hmm. knows, there've been a lot of them. This one really felt like the big one, and I think to me it still feels like a turning point. I think we reached in 2007 the peak of. Free market regulation, no government involvement, you know, market can do what it wants, let the risk models, private sector risk models regulate everything, you know, peak of leverage, peak of the idea that you should invest all you can in the stock market,
right.
you know, we build up, et cetera. And I think everything that's happened since then is going to be retrenchment from there, and that it's the end of that you know, innocence on Wall Street, the end of the belief that the private sector needs no restrictions or regulations or check on it. You know, the end of the era where a Fed chief like Alan Greenspan could say derivative contracts negotiated by private individuals don't need regulation because they'll do what's in the best interest of their institutions.
Right.
The end of that, you know, I think I drew this in the book that there was this idea that you know, that when the Soviet Union fell, it was the end of history, and 9/11 was the end of that end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a similar sort of innocence that, you know, we had Wall Street didn't need government anymore, and 2008 was the end of that. And I don't, you know, I know it's popular to say everything is back the same. I don't think everything is back the same. And if you look at the level of the government involvement in the system, you know, the 9 out of 10 mortgages being bought by Fannie Mae, the level of supervision from Dodd-Frank, the new agencies, I think we're going back and will remain in a world where there are greater checks, more government involvement, you know, in some ways better, in some ways worse, I'm sure. But so I think that's the tide has gone in, and I think will remain in, you know, to some degree.
Yeah, the you know, I think in an early note to you, I mentioned that I was struck by the fact that you started your book with Fannie Mae, right? Maybe
yeah.
on the first page. What do you think is the prognosis for the GSEs? Are they ever going to become public again? Are they? Do you have any sense of that? I mean,
kind of unhappy because I fear that the path of least resistance, which is sort of keep them the same, but this time we'll do it better, is what they're headed towards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Geithner said he wants. He wants a public guarantee, but he doesn't want moral hazard. And no one's ever explained to me how you can have both.
Right.
And, you know, we have a lot of experience now, I mean, observing that, you know, Other countries don't have GSEs. They have mortgage markets. They have the same level of home ownership. And I think, I guess they should be part of a broader question of to what extent do we want to subsidize home ownership. Yeah, obviously, the mortgage deduction is, well, not obviously, but to me, it's a complete waste. You know, but things that just...
Let me ask a question. Do you pay a mortgage?
I do.
Okay.
And I'm at the level where I benefit from one. Mm-hmm. But for the deduction, I mean. You know, to me, it's just taking money out of the hands of renters and putting it in the hands of owners and real estate agents. And probably raising prices of how, you know, raising housing prices absent some change in the underlying fundamentals is not a good thing, as we've seen.
Right.
And I think the whole, you know, notion, you know, there are lots of ways to build communities, you know, a sense of community. You know, we can have better transportation systems, we can have better schools. You know, the idea of subsidizing every American to be able to build, you know, a den onto their home, that was sort of the way we'd take it, and it didn't work. And you know, if we're going to subsidize home ownership, I would say pass a bill, you know, allocate $50 or $100 billion a year, raise taxes by that amount to pay for it, and be honest about it that we're paying for it instead of, well, this won't cost us anything, it's just a guarantee.
Right. Have you...
I got about five more minutes.
That's fine, because I'm going to raise your last question. Is in terms of what you've heard about the commission or thought about the commission, do you have any expectations from the commission when you see this report?
No, I'm very curious. You know, wish you best. You know,
yeah.
How about it?
Oh, it's you know, it's a process with many hands, and it's going well. And
I'm sure.
I've certainly enjoyed it. So,
cool.
I think in that case, I think that pretty much covers everything. So I'll let you go with a few minutes to spare.
Great. All right. Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Yes. Thanks very much.
I look forward to your work.
Thanks. Right,
bye-bye.
Bye.